Blog Talk Radio.
Being quite a week. Let me see. Seems like there's no sound again. Do you guys hear me? Let's try that. All right. So nobody's hearing anything. That's weird. 1, 2, 3. Can you guys hear me? Anything? All right. It's good now. We can hear you now. Okay, something's very, very weird. Something's very, very weird. So we're going to have to look into this blog talk and find out why. Did anybody hear the music? I'm just curious on the chat if anybody heard the music. Okay. Nobody heard it. All right, so here we go. Let's assume we just started the show now and... Right. That was quite a week last week. We had Obama in Cuba and in Argentina making all kinds of comments about communism, about capitalism, about the relationship between them. And we are going to talk about that. It was quite a week on the foreign policy front. We had ISIS commit a couple of bombings in three bombings actually in Belgium, attempt a fourth that failed. About 30 people were killed, over 100 injured. Just a horrific terrorist attack in both the airports and the train station, subway station in the Belgian capital of Brussels, and really kind of the European capital of Brussels. Brussels is the home of the European Union bureaucracy. So it is very much the capital de facto of the European Union. And in the heart of that, capital, we got a major terrorist attack. At the same time, you know, kind of the U.S. response to this, it seems, was you know, we killed ISIS number two leader again. So a lot of action. We'll talk about killing of ISIS's number two leader and what that even means. All right. So what we're going to do today is we're going to start off by talking about the events in Belgium. My commentary on the events of Belgium and what I think needs to be done and whether there is even a problem here. Obama has said that terrorism is no big deal. More people die in the shower than do from terrorist attacks. Indeed, I've heard many people tell me the more people die from traffic accidents, more people die, I don't know, from things like pneumonia and a bunch of other things than do from terrorist attacks. So what is the big deal? Why get so excited about terrorism? I often get asked. So we'll talk about that. And then we're going to have Don Watkins join us at 12 o'clock Pacific time. In about 27 minutes to discuss next week, which is an exciting week because next week we get the launch of Equal is Unfair. So very excited about the launch of Equal is Unfair. And, you know, this morning I woke up and Equal is Unfair in the Amazon bestseller list had beaten out Thomas Piketty, Das Kapital for the 21st Century. So Piketty's book, Capital in the 21st Century, which was a bestseller last year, now is number two for now, whereas Don Watkins and my book, Equal is Unfair, is number one. But to keep it at number one, to keep Equal is Unfair at number one, you guys are going to have to help promote it. So some of you I know have bought the book already. I know for a fact that many of you have not. And I'd ask you again, I think this is, as you'll hear when we discuss it with Don, this is an important book. This is a book that I think will help you understand the world around you much, much better. Will give you, really give you, significant intellectual ammunition to defend yourself against the onslaught of egalitarianism that is going on in the world today. And it will help change the world. So not only should you be buying a book for yourself and maybe for your friends, but you should definitely help us promote the book. So I'd really appreciate any help you guys can give in promoting your book, the book, telling your friends, posting it on Twitter, talking about it on Facebook, talking about it on Reddit, and any other place. I don't know, you know, maybe even tape a video and put it up on Vine. I haven't got into Vine yet, but you guys should do it in Vine. And for now, the book is only in English, but, you know, let's work on getting it translated. Spanish, Portuguese, Chinese, Greek, Polish. We've got a good following in Poland. And any other language you can think of, help us get the book out there, get it into the culture, because the onslaught of egalitarianism that is already happening is only going to increase. And think about the fact that something like 90% of all young Democrats, of all Democrats who are voting in the Democratic primary, who are under the age of 25, are voting for Bernie Sanders. Bernie Sanders. Right? So this is the book, Equal is Unfair, that dismisses the whole rhetoric, the Sanders rhetoric, billionaires and millionaires, as if they have caused all the problems in the world. So pick it up. And hopefully it'll maintain its position. It maintained its position above Thomas Piketty's best-selling neo-Marxist book, Capital in the 21st Century. And again, really, really, what would really help, and we'll talk about this more with Don, is if you guys promote it on your social media, on the variety of social media ways that you have. And then if you could, when you read the book, only after you read the book, and if you like it or don't like it, whatever, post a review on Amazon. Really helps if we have reviews on Amazon. Really I will be really thankful if you guys just post a quick review of Amazon. All right. Finally, I will be discussing Obama's comments in Argentina about his trip to Cuba and about the differences or whether young people should be supportive of communism or capitalism. I'll read a little bit out of what he actually said, because there's a lot of distortions, as there always is, always on. And then we'll talk about some, a good movie, a good book or something as the positive value section. I hope you all, you know, watching the movies I'm recommending and enjoy them. All right. Foreign policy. And I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this. I've talked a lot about foreign policy, and every time there's a terrorist attack, my comments are basically the same. And I about what we need to do and what needs to be done, and I'll continue talking about that. And we don't have a lot of time, but in the 20 minutes, I want to start off by comments I heard this week from people quoting Obama and saying that Obama's attitude towards these things, towards terrorist attacks, is, look, what's the big deal, right? Not that many people die in the big picture. ISIS is not an existential threat to the United States. They're not going to take over the United States. They're not a threat to the existence of the American government. Why get so excited about a terrorist attack in Belgium? Two Americans died, but that's two. I mean, two Americans probably die every second in a traffic accident, and we don't get all revved up and we don't focus all our attention. And somebody actually said, you know, the whole terrorism thing is a creation of the media. The media is what has driven this whole attention to terrorism. And that is what is driving our concern and fear over terrorism. Now, I consider these comments nuts, crazy. I mean, we shouldn't be concerned about child molesters because it's not that many children. We shouldn't be concerned about serial killers because, you know, it's not that many. They don't kill that many people. There aren't that many serial killers in any given year. I mean, to compare terrorism to traffic accidents or falling in the bathtub or accidents is absurd. Accidents will happen. Accidents are part of life. They're part of the risk of being alive. And one can take precautions about them. One can be careful. One can avoid traffic accidents, not all of them, because sometimes they're not your fault, but by driving carefully, by being aware. One can avoid falling in the bathtub by you know, maybe exercising, by maintaining good balance, by watching one that does, not letting the soap fall on the, you know, to the bottom, to the bathtub, so one slips on the soap. I don't know. I mean, this is all pretty stupid. Initiation of force is a different category. It's a different type of phenomena. It is the essence of evil. The attempt of people to use force in order to get their way, whether through stealing or whether through killing you or whether through blowing up large numbers of people, is downright evil and can be avoided only by taking it seriously. There's no precaution you can take other than locking yourself at home. There's no precaution while living that you can take. And I mean properly living. And this is the exact role of government. The actual role of government is to go out there and protect us from the initiation of force. This is what we elected Obama to do. Only thing we elected, we should be electing presidents to do. In the case of Obama, we also elected him to give us a lot of free goodies, which he had to initiate force in order to do. But a proper government, this is their number one concern. Now, it's true. I think people panic, over worry, overreact to terrorism as individuals. So I, for a moment, flashed in my mind, oh my God, should I go to Europe? Later in May, I'll be in Europe later in May, and I'm going to Paris and I'm going to Amsterdam, which have large Muslim population. And then it occurred to me, that's ridiculous, right? The probability of something actually happening to me in Europe is very, very small. So in terms of the decision-making I make on a day-to-day, I'm not going to make a decision based on terrorism. I'm not going to leave my house because there were shooters in San Bernardino, which is really, really close to where I live. Because there might be more shooters this time in Orange County or whatever. You can't live your life based on that. You have to live. But that is not the attitude the government can take. You can take that as an individual, and you should take that as an individual. Terrorism will not affect my life. The likelihood of terrorism affecting my life is close to zero. So it won't change the way I behave. And this is true here, and to some extent it's true in Israel. Now in Israel, the probability of you being affected by terrorism is much, much larger. And still, you got to live your life. That's not the attitude of the government. The government attitude has to be, this is a risk that it is our job. Our sole responsibility is to eliminate this risk from the lives of our citizens. It is our responsibility to eliminate the risk of terrorism from the lives of our citizens. And that's true for the American government and the Israeli government. And I have to say both the American government and the Israeli government are failing. The Belgian government is failing. The French government is failing. Obama to say it's not an existential threat or it's no big deal. Yeah, it's not an existential threat. I agree. ISIS is not going to conquer the United States. I agree. For you as an individual, you shouldn't be making decisions on whether to go to Paris or not based on terrorist attacks. Certainly not given their frequency right now. But the government must. This is their obligation. This is their job. This is their responsibility. This is the one thing we have them for. Now, how to do it is a different question, and we'll get to that in a minute. We've got a call. I assume it's on this topic, so I'm going to take it. Hi, you're on the Iran Brook Show. Who's this?
Noah.
Hey, Noah. How's it going?
Hey, pretty good, pretty good. So it is about this topic, and this is my point. I don't disagree with anything you've said, but I feel that we argue with the leftists in the wrong way because these comments about the bath, falling in the bathroom, all that, that's not their way of saying, really, they're not measuring the murders in total numbers and saying, well, it's not that big of a deal. Once it gets to a higher number, we'll worry about them. That's their way of saying, really, we don't care. He's clearly shown himself to be anti-American. He doesn't care about terrorist attacks on innocents. He's pro-Islam. So the same way it goes with any other racism. They don't care about racism because they don't care about Africa's slavery currently. They don't care about feminists. Feminists don't care about women. They don't care about what's going on in the Middle East and women. So we're arguing wrong with them. We shouldn't argue, even though I think you should say that to the your argument today is appropriate for regular people who are not anti-American. They need to know the facts, and that is the government's job to take care of these, even though they're not that common. But really, when you're arguing with Obama, he doesn't care. He doesn't want to defend America.
I agree with you completely, Noah. You're absolutely right. The point is that you shouldn't argue with Obama. That is the only argument you can make to what you'd call regular people, because Obama and his cronies and the people surrounding him, the radical left that I agree with you completely, doesn't care about American lives, doesn't care about America, doesn't care about racism, doesn't care about women. They're nihilists, and there's nothing you could do with nihilists. They're haters. They hate America. They hate success. They hate women. They hate, you know, they hate anything positive. They want to knock down. They want to destroy. And therefore, there's no point in debating them. But what they need to be is unmasked in front of the American people. They need to be unmasked in terms of their true intentions. And it's hard to do because most people don't accept the existence of nihilism. Most people just can't comprehend it. Most good people can't comprehend that somebody hates for the sake of hating, hates the good for being the good, to quote Ayn Rand. So you have to argue that they are nihilists and how they're nihilists and prove it, which is not easy to do. And that's kind of what I'm trying to do, but I'm not talking to Obama. I have no interest in talking to Obama. I think I would actually turn my back and walk away. If I had the opportunity to talk to Obama, it would be a complete and utter waste of time.
But when you're arguing in the heat of, when you're on the college campuses, you're arguing with many Obamas sort of.
You're not going to convince them. You're not going to convince them. So when I do debates, and when I go on campus, college campuses and answer questions, I'm not arguing with the questioner and I'm not arguing with the debater. I'm arguing with the better minds in the audience. So when I do a debate, I don't care what James Galbraith or what the guy on the other side of the debate is saying. That's not relevant. I'm not trying to convince him. I am trying to convince the audience, the better people in the audience. So, and always remember that, because when you get into debate with a nihilist, where are you going to go? What are you going to do? Because you're not going to convince them. Their whole point is they want to destroy. You can't change that. That's almost a metaphysical value judgment that they've made. That you're not going to. It's almost impossible for you to challenge. So you have to think about who else is listening and who can I get to.
But rather than convincing the nihilists, I think the only way to win this battle, you have to expose the nihilists to the normal person. And that's what I'm trying, using those examples of feminism. And I think that's pretty convincing, but there's no way to win this unless you expose them without using the word nihilism, because then they'll just tune out.
I agree with you. I agree with you. And if you read Equal is Unfair, the final two chapters of Equal is Unfair is really devoted to exposing the egalitarians, to exposing what they really are, which is nihilists, and to showing what they really want in the end, which is death.
Well, I just ordered my copy. Ordered my copy on Amazon, so I hope it comes out on Audible soon, because I prefer to listen to books.
It's out on Audible. It's available on Audible.
Oh, great.
Yeah, go to Amazon. There's a Audible button right there on the right, just right of hard copy. And I guess you can get it from Audible themselves, but I know it's available on Audible on Amazon.
Great. Thanks a lot.
Good. Well, thanks, Noah. I agree with you completely, so I'm not disagreeing with you. I think they do have to be exposed completely as the nihilists that they are. And thanks for calling. Even if even if we don't mention it. And I'll talk more about Obama's nihilism when we get to talking about what he said about capitalism and communism. But you're right. They say it's no big deal, partially because they don't care, partially because it's a nihilistic tendency. And then for some on the left, it becomes a rationalization. So for some on the left who are not, let's say, nihilistic, because not everybody on the left is a nihilist, they hear it said and they go, oh, yeah, okay, I get that. And you know, why send American troops to die, or why kill a lot of innocent civilians? And not that many Americans are dying out of this. It's not that big of a threat. And they use it as a rationalization. And that's the other thing we have to do. We have to destroy the rationalization. We have to make clear that the rationalization is ridiculous. It's ridiculous. So Obama doesn't care. I agree completely. Obama's whole foreign policy is based on the idea that he is, you know, he thinks the United States are the bad guys. He thinks, you know, we're unfit and unworthy to defend ourselves. To defend ourselves. And certainly that once we get involved in other countries, that it always turns into a disaster and we can't actually manage it and it's not worth it. And, you know, who are we to lead and who are we to assert ourselves and who are we to do anything? So there is no defending ourselves except nominally. For example, a big deal was made this week out of the killing of ISIS's number two leader, and all the everybody reported it, Carter, the Ash Carter, the U.S. Defense Secretary, went out and, you know, was very proud of the fact that our special forces and granted, our special forces, it sounds like, did a phenomenal job by, you know, catching these guys on the border between Iraq and Syria. Or what used to be the border between Iraq and Syria, they surrounded them. So these were troops on the ground. As far as I know, they took no casualties, and they managed to kill the number two of ISIS for the third time. So Ash Carter has announced over the last year and a half the killing of ISIS's number two person for the third time, because they keep killing the number two person, and ISIS does what? They keep replacing their number two person. This is what Israel did for many, many years. It still does, I think. Targeted Hamas leaders. They keep killing Hamas leaders, and Hamas keeps replacing Hamas leaders. You cannot win this by selectively killing a few leaders. You cannot win this by improving intelligence. You cannot win this by disrupting a few networks in Europe. You cannot win this on the defense. You cannot win this unless you're willing to acknowledge, identify, specify the enemy. You have to name the enemy. It's not ISIS. It's not ISIS. It's jihadism. It's radical Islam. It's Islamism, you know, it doesn't really, the actual name doesn't matter that much. It matters, but it doesn't matter that much. If Islam is part of the name, that's what's important. To recognize that it's an ideology and that the roots of the ideology are in Islam. Now, as you know, Islamic totalitarianism is my preferred title, but it is long. It's many, many syllables and it's hard to say. So jihadism is not bad because it's a little shorter. But the point is that naming it as Islam is not very useful because doesn't pinpoint who the enemy is. You have to modify Islam by something to know who the enemy, not the ideological enemy. In a sense, ideological enemy is Islam. But the political enemy, the military enemy is Islamic totalitarianism. And you have to name the enemy. And you have to be willing to destroy the enemy. Those are the requirements for victory. Naming the enemy and a willingness an unflinching willingness that neither Republicans nor Democrats seem to have to actually destroy the enemy. But the first step is naming it, and it's so, so important, because once you name it, then it becomes obvious that the enemy, is not ISIS primarily, but the people who make ISIS possible. It's not Al-Qaeda primarily, but it's the people who make Al-Qaeda possible. Who are the people who make possible San Bernardino, Paris, Belgium, where they weren't all Muslim immigrants into Europe. Some of them were born in Belgium. How did they get so radicalized? They weren't born so radical. Their parents are not that radical. So you have to look at the source. And the source, financially, spiritually, politically, ideologically, is not in ISIS, it's not in Al-Qaeda, it's in Saudi Arabia. It's a Saudi Arabia. It's in Iran. The source of this ideology, the source of the funding of all the mosques that radicalize, the source of the funding of all the madrasas that radicalize, are in Saudi Arabia and in Iran, nowhere else. So until you make it so painful for the Saudis and the Iranians to continue their support, which they do all the time. You think ISIS could exist without money from the Gulf, without oil money? They could not. Without help from factions within the Saudi regime, without help from Qatar and Dubai and all these so-called westernized parts of the Middle East, they could not exist. So, you know, anyway, until we identify Saudi Arabia as the enemy, we cannot win this. Until we identify Iran as the enemy, we cannot win this. The Islamic totalitarians as the enemy, we cannot win this. And until we understand that Islam as a religion is driving all this, we cannot win this. You crush the Saudis, you crush the Iranians, you make it clear to them the consequence of continuing the support, continuing the spreading of these radical ideas, and they will stop. And you can't allow it. You cannot allow Saudi money to be funding all this radicalization all over the world with no comment and no retribution. Nothing. Complete silence. All right, so as you know my solution, and if you don't, then I encourage you all to go out and read Winning the Unwinnable War, which is edited by Ilan Juno, and it has a number of essays by myself and also Alex Epstein, and of course primarily Ilan Juno, and it is really my answer to how do you solve this. It's my answer to what needs to be done in great detail with great explanation and articulates exactly what the case is, who the enemy is, and how we go about winning this war. All right. We're going to take a quick break. And when we get back, we'll have Don Watkins on the line and we'll be talking about Equal is Unfair, what we have planned for next week in terms of promoting the book. And then after Don, we're going to talk about Obama, communism, and capitalism. So stay right here, and we'll be back in just about 4 minutes.
Selfishness, a virtue? It is according to the moral principles of objectivism. Conventional morality tells you to sacrifice your values to satisfy the needs of others. Ayn Rand opposes that view and offers a new concept of egoism, an ethics of rational selfishness that rejects sacrifice in all its forms. In The Virtue of Selfishness, Ayn Rand defies conventional thought, setting out a philosophy that holds man as a heroic being, with his own happiness as the moral purpose of his life. Explore Rand's new concept of egoism and order The Virtue of Selfishness at Amazon.com today.
You didn't build that. You don't pay your fair share. Who do you think you are? Ayn Rand knew exactly who you are. Rational, productive, independent. You work hard and use your own judgment. You choose your career path, your lifestyle, your values. You're living the American dream. And now you see that there are people who want to take away what you've created and who will call their lust to loot a virtue. People who think the needs of others is a claim on your money, your work, your life. Well, how can you fight back? That's what they do at the Ayn Rand Institute. They look closely at public policy beyond sound bites and election cycles, at the fundamental moral ideas that frame crucial debates. They focus on reframing the issues in line with reason, egoism, and individual rights to life, liberty, property, and the pursuit of happiness. Your life, liberty, property, and the pursuit of your happiness. Stand up with them to fight against the sacrifice of your values by making a contribution today at AynRand.org/support. They'll use your money to defend your values.
The Ayn Rand Institute's mission is to promote Ayn Rand's philosophy of reason, rational self-interest, and laissez-faire capitalism. We are currently looking for talented, passionate, and bright people who share our goal of advancing Ayn Rand's ideas in the world. The Ayn Rand Institute offers you the opportunity to impact the culture and make a difference each and every day. If you're interested in working at the Ayn Rand Institute, visit us at AynRand.org today. There you'll find details on employment opportunities and how to apply.
Ayn Rand was a radical thinker whose philosophical novels challenged students to reconsider their views on fundamental issues. The Fountainhead, Atlas Shrugged, and Anthem. These works have become classics of American literature that never fail to engage young people and stimulate intense classroom discussion. By offering these works for free to teachers, the Ayn Rand Institute hopes to encourage greater awareness and understanding of Rand's stimulating perspective. If you're a teacher who would like Ayn Rand's books in your classroom, visit AynRand.org. This is at no cost to you. Go to AynRand.org today.
For 30 years, the Ayn Rand Institute has been on the front lines of the culture wars, introducing millions of students to Ayn Rand's books and ideas, educating young intellectuals who now teach at universities around the world, and speaking out in defense of free speech, free markets, and free minds. You can join our battle for reason, individualism, and capitalism by making your contribution today at AynRand.org/support.
You've heard the endless warnings. Economic inequality is growing and will continue to grow. But the question almost no one asks is, why should we care? It's an important question. Economic inequality has nothing to do with poverty. In some countries, people are relatively equal and extremely poor. In other countries, like the United States, people are relatively unequal, and the vast majority of people are, by world standards, extremely rich. Inequality just means there's a gap between what different people earn. And the gap can grow even if every single individual is becoming better off. And that's really the story of capitalism. Economic progress makes us all better off, just at different rates. So, why should we care about inequality? For more on inequality, see the new book by Yaron Brook and Don Watkins, Equal is Unfair, America's Misguided Fight Against Income Inequality, out in bookstores everywhere on March 29th. For more information, go to equalisunfair.com. That's equalisunfair.com.
Well, with that lead in by from Mark Pellegrino in that final ad, let's get Don on the line. Don Watkins, my co-author on Equal is Unfair. Hey, Don.
Hey, how's it going?
Good, good. So you excited? Book's coming out in a couple of days.
Yeah, a couple days. I'm headed to New York tomorrow, and we'll be teaming up on Tuesday, the day of the release, for what should be a really cool event in New York. Hopefully people will be able to make it out to that one.
Yeah, so this is an event on Tuesday the 29th, the day of the publication, and we're doing an event at CUNY, which is the local university there in Manhattan, and we got a good moderator who I think is going to make this interesting. It's kind of going to be a conversation, me and Don and DeRoy Murdoch, who is a pretty good kind of conservative thinker, non-objectivist, but I think that'll make it interesting.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think it's a good opportunity to kind of bring out some of what's unique about our approach that you don't hear from conservatives or libertarians for that matter.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, DeRoy is a writer. He's written in many places. He's a Fox News contributor. You probably seen him quite a bit on TV. So this is going to be at 7 p.m. Eastern time at the CUNY Graduate Center on the ninth floor. That's on 365 Fifth Avenue. But you can go to ary.einrand.org/events, ary.einrand.org/events, and get information. Because we've got a number of events going on next week. After Tuesday, where are you off to after New York? Don?
Then I'm headed to D.C. We're going to be doing an event with the Manhattan Institute, among other events. And so that one is open to the public, and that'll be great. Scott Winship from Manhattan will be there, who's a really excellent researcher on the statistics and the inequality debate. And then Richard Reeves, who's from the I think Brookings. And he's actually a very, you know, solid, respected thinker on the left. And so I think we're going to have a really interesting discussion about this whole issue. And then after that, you know, who knows, I think Colorado and Texas. And then I'm actually going to return and get to writing, because there's so much more to say in this issue. You know, it never ends.
Yeah. So we've got a bunch of events coming up in the next 2 weeks. Don is going to be with me in New York, and then he'll be in D.C. So look for events in New York and D.C. I'm going to be next week in Connecticut. I'll be at Yale and in Stanford, and also in New York at Columbia University, and then Boston, and then Dickinson College in, I don't know, middle of nowhere, Pennsylvania. And then the following week, when Don's in D.C., I'll be on the West Coast. I'll be doing Portland, Oregon, and Lewis and Clark University, and then in San Francisco at the Commonwealth Club. So if you're in the Bay Area, definitely would love to see you at the Commonwealth Club, and would really appreciate the support that you can give us. So we've talked quite a bit about Equal is Unfair here and in other places. What do you think, Don, makes this book stand out from all the other stuff that's out there on inequality, and really from what I think a lot of maybe conservatives, libertarians, and some objectivists think, how they think about this idea?
Oh my gosh, where to get started? I would say one non-obvious thing is I think our book really lays out how the critics of inequality think about the issue, that we go very deep into their whole philosophic, economic, and in particular their moral framework. And I think that's so critical for understanding the arguments, because a lot of what's going on is that they have a certain framework. And if you're going to boil it down to one word, I would say it's a collectivist framework. That is, they view the group as superior to the individual. And so the standard of whether or not you're allowed to have wealth is not, did you earn it and are you going to use it for your own happiness? But it's, is this going to serve society? But then they also have what, and philosophically you might put as a metaphysical framework, that is, they view the source of wealth, the source of achievement, is all coming from society. And that feeds into their economics. It feeds into everything. And what they really try to do with a lot of their arguments is try to basically, in effect, say to Americans that if you really care about the American dream, if you care about opportunity, prosperity, progress, then basically you need to accept collectivism. And so you need to understand their framework to be able to see through those arguments. But I think on the positive side is that this is not a book that's just picking apart their statistics or showing that they have wrong economic views. This is really a celebration of productive achievement. And to celebrate productive achievement is really only possible if you have an individualist moral standard, one that values the individual and your ability to make the most of your life. And I think that is so badly needed today, because even when we have a lot of great producers around us, they're so mistreated. And I think even for themselves, they produce a lot and they do such a great job, but they don't appreciate and enjoy it and feel pride and happiness as a result as much as they should.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And it really is sad how many people, even on our side, talk about inequality or talk about the evils of socialism or talk about the evils of egalitarianism, but how little appreciation there is for the value of wealth creation, what it takes, what value creation actually requires, and how the value creators truly are the atlases that carry the world on their shoulders. you get so much anti-business rhetoric out of conservatives and out of libertarians that it really is sickening. It's understandable to some extent because of cronyism, but really is sickening from the broader.
Oh yeah, I mean, look, we talk about cronyism, the book, and we talk about it quite a bit, you know, in the interviews and stuff we do. But if your first reaction when somebody talks about people who achieve great wealth through business activity is, what about cronyism? That is ridiculous. That and I'm sure you've heard this, Yaron, but so many times from conservatives and libertarians, you know, I'll talk about productive achievement and some of my personal heroes, including one who recently died, very sadly, Andy Grove from Intel. And their first reaction is, you know, cronyism, businessmen getting favors from Washington. And I mean, that's like saying, oh, I really love, you know, superstar athletes. And somebody says, yeah, but what about the doping scandal with Lance Armstrong? Like, you really don't value great people if your first reaction is to point in the direction of you know, people who are, in effect, frauds.
Yeah, no, I think that's absolutely right. I was on a panel, I think it was at the University of Virginia, and the guy sitting next to me, the only way he could think about the world is through the framework of cronyism. And it's interesting, he was a leftist who thought that basically the very definition of property rights creates cronyism, right? Because the government is protecting property rights, and therefore those who happen to have property are the beneficiaries of the government, and completely confused about the difference between cronyism and about the appropriate role of government. But what was shocking is that his book was being co-authored, this book he was writing about cronyism, was co-authored by a libertarian. I guess not that shocking. The left and libertarians, some libertarians have a lot in common from that respect. They view any government action as a form of, they see no separation between economic and political power, no separation between coercion and voluntary trade and exchange, because even voluntary trade and exchange, they believe, is based on coercion, which is the definition of property rights, which is just bizarre.
Yeah, so I mean, this is another of the value of our books, is because we come at things from philosophy. One thing philosophy teaches you to do is be like very, very clear about how you conceptualize things and not to have vague categories that blend together different things. And so one of the dangers of a word like cronyism, because it's a little vague, but certainly even more dangerous, a word that is often treated as its equivalent, rent seeking, is that it's not clear what is included in that concept and what isn't. And so what you often get is you get things that are certainly not cronyism, like property rights, blended in with things that rightfully are, such as getting a subsidy from the government. And rent seeking is even more dangerous because by some people's assessment, any profitability is a special favor from the government. It's a market failure. And in the book, we're super clear about the distinction. The distinction is, did you get it, what you have through production and voluntary trade or through physical force? And like, that's a bright line distinction. Are you stealing from people, or are you achieving something? And if you keep that in mind, then I think that's just, it's so clarifying, and it really prevents this kind of negative, undue negative view of business.
Yeah, and it sad thing is that undue negative view of business is so popular today. It's so common. You get it from left and right. You get it from Bernie Sanders on the one hand, but you also get it to some extent from Donald Trump, and certainly from people like Kasich and the so-called compassionate conservatives, and even from the Ron Pauls of the world, or the Rand Pauls of the world. The way they say Wall Street is indicative of everything they think about banking and about so-called big business. It really is frustrating.
Oh, it's really frustrating, and I think a lot of it is cowardice. Not all of it, but a lot of it is that many people who are, you know, broadly on the right, they feel most comfortable and excited when they can seem to agree with the left, because they always view the left as having the moral high ground. So anytime that they can blame businessmen from an allegedly free market perspective, that's like, hey, man, I've got it made now. Now I can feel really good about myself because everybody on the left is going to like me.
Yeah, and they don't get that that's why they lose all the time, because they basically granted the left the moral high ground, and it's all over once you do that. I want to go back to something you said earlier about Andy Grove, because I kind of gone unnoticed in the news cycle that Andy Grove, one of the great business leaders of the 20th century, I would say, died this week, and that's that was sad. I saw a number of people posting tributes to him. What is your sense of Andy Grove and his significance in the business community?
I mean, and you can probably speak to this too, but by everything that I've read and seen, I mean, he is widely and properly credited with helping not just turn Intel into one of the most successful companies in history, but in really shaping the culture of Silicon Valley. And to the extent that we have this kind of innovative culture that values just, you know, constantly improving, constantly moving things forward, taking big risks to the and even smaller aspects of Silicon Valley. The idea of we're not going to focus on hierarchy. That is, if you're just an engineer and you think that we're doing things the wrong way. So Andy Grove actually worked out a cubicle the entire time at Intel, and you know, people were encouraged to come by and argue with him and debate him, because the whole idea was good ideas should win, not people with a title. And so, on large and small scale, he helped shape and create the computer revolution and everything else that Silicon Valley has done. And just to give you, connect it to the inequality debate you're on, yesterday I read this article from inequality.org, and the guy who heads it wrote on, as his, quote, tribute to this guy, yeah, everybody says that he was great, and yeah, if you look at the statistics, he grew – Intel by something like 12,000%. But at the end of the day, why did he get paid so much more than the people under him?
Yeah.
And set aside how absurd that is when you take somebody who's created untold amounts of wealth and you're wondering why did he get paid more than everybody else. But that, this is what you say when somebody of that quality has died. And by the standards of the inequality people, you would think that this would be a guy that they would love, because he was not an ostentatious guy. I don't think there's anything wrong with buying a ton of nice cars or nice houses if you've earned it, but he didn't. He lived a pretty modest life. Like I said, he was, he was not throwing around his rank at people, but if you're successful, you are evil by their standards.
He was such an illustration of so much that's good about this country and those kind of attitudes. And the fact that he wasn't even more celebrated is an illustration of what's so wrong in this country. I mean, think about this guy. He was born in Hungary. He escaped from communism at the age of 20, basically risking his life to cross the border from Hungary to Austria. Somehow made it to the United States. I guess no thanks to Ted Cruz and Donald Trump, who would build the wall and exclude H-1B people. But he didn't even have a degree, so he wouldn't even qualify for an H-1B. He came here, got a bachelor's degree in chemical engineering at the City College of New York, not an Ivy League school, but did well. Got a PhD in chemical engineering, landed up in Fairchild Semiconductor, where a lot of these greats landed up, and became, director of development there. And then together with Robert Noyce and Gordon Moore, the two co-founders of Intel, left Fairchild and went to work at Intel, an engineer from a communist country, who landed up being one of the great CEOs, one of the great innovators, one of the great business leaders in American history. And I think you're absolutely right, a real shaper of the culture. I mean, there's some videos I've seen of him just talking about technology and talking about its direction. And he strikes me as just a thoughtful, really, really smart guy. And, a genius who really is one of the best representatives of capitalism and of what America is all about. The American dream and American opportunity is all about. And yeah, he became fabulously rich. Good for him. I mean, this is what our book celebrates, and this is what we should all be celebrating.
Let me tell just briefly my favorite story about him, because it gives a little meat to the kind of mind and courage that he had, which was Intel was originally a memory chip maker. They weren't a microprocessor company, and they had been the leading one, then they were overtaken by the Japanese. And if you look at the history of business, whenever a business that's been successful for a while gets in this situation, they almost always just fail. Like they don't take big risks to self-correct because that's just not how big organizations work. And he and Robert Noyce sat down one day and said, all right, what are we going to do? And the question they raise is, well, if we get fired, what would the next CEO do? And they said, well, it would get us out of memories and into processors. And that was and that's what they did. And that's what really saved the company and made it the company that it is today and made the, you know, computers, the PC revolution possible. And it's easy to underestimate how much courage it takes to take that kind of big risky decision with a major company. And the fact that he did that, I just think is like, I'm in awe of that.
Yeah, I mean, there's a number of really good quotes relating to that from him. He said that succeed breeds complacency. Complacency breeds failure. Only the paranoid survive. Now, paranoid not in the sense of a psychological illness, but as a sense of always questioning, always challenging, always looking over your shoulder. He also said a corporation is a living organism. It has to continue to shed its skin. Methods have to change. Focus has to change. Values have to change. The sum total of these changes is transformation. And you know, that's what Steve Jobs did at Apple. And that's what Andy Groves did at Intel. And that's what so many people haven't done at their successful companies. And as a consequence of that, have failed, have gone out of existence. So many companies that we used to be household names don't exist anymore. Compaq, even HP. Where's HP from the glory days of because it didn't change. It didn't shed its skin. It didn't transform and adapt to a changing world. So, yeah,
I mean,
to learn.
You run a company and, you know, roughly, what, 40, 50 people, and yeah. I think we've done some amazing changes, but you know how hard that's been with 40 or 50 people. I mean, can you imagine doing it for thousands?
It truly is amazing. It truly is amazing. And there they had to change. Our product pretty much stays the same. But there they had to change products. They have to shift completely and say, you know, our comparative advantage is really – I don't know if they said this exactly, but something like our engineering power, our brain power, how do we apply this engineering power and brain power to the next problem rather than to the old problem? And that is just – that's truly, truly amazing and truly spectacular. All right. Now, we've only got you for another few minutes. So talk a little bit about what the listeners – and we've got a lot of listeners. So I've told the listeners before that every single one of them buys a book, that this book will be a bestseller. There's no question about that. But what can they do beyond just buying a book, which they should, and they should feel guilty if they haven't yet? What can they do to help promote the book? What can we do to get the word out there that our listeners out there can help us achieve, so that this becomes not – I told the audience before that this morning we took Thomas Piketty. We took the number one slot from him on Amazon on inequality. But what can we do to maintain that slot and to actually get this book into a significant bestseller list? How can they help?
Yeah. So, I mean, part of the context here is like, we're in this for the long game, but in terms of the marginal value of buying a book, it's never higher than in the first week. And so if you plan on giving books away, now's the time to stock up. In fact, if you buy five and send us the receipt, five or more, we'll also send you a free Equal is Unfair t-shirt. You just email us about that. And this is actually, I mean this seriously, this is one of the best things you can do, because what we found is that when people see the title, it starts a conversation, and there's many people hungry for a message like that, because they have this sense that, you know, part of what we're losing in this country is respect for achievement and trying to just hold everybody down. And so, like, that is one of the biggest things you can do, because it's going to be word of mouth that can really move books, aside from just piles of cash. So I would say, you know, buy those five books, get a t-shirt, and then go to a Bernie Sanders rally and film yourself.
Oh, there you go. There you go. You can learn from Alex Epstein, the famous video of Alex standing in the global warming parade in New York City with I Love Fossil Fuel t-shirt and big sign. If we had 1,000 people doing that on each one of these issues, I think we changed the world. So go out there and put on your T-shirt, Equal is Unfair, and go to a Bernie Sanders rally. That's a great idea. Other things you could do, once they read the book, put up a review on Amazon. Does that help?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, the review, one of the major things that people nowadays do in deciding to get a book is read reviews. And so, you know, decide what you think of it and then let people know. And, you know, the more reviews and the more thoughtful reviews. So this is not an Amazon review, but somebody that we know, Ari Armstrong, wrote a really good analysis that gave a real fair evaluation and overview of the book's arguments. And those things matter. Those things can take somebody from I wasn't going to buy it to I am going to buy it. So any sort of reviews, particularly on Amazon, are always really helpful.
Yeah, and you know, use social media. Social media is a great marketing tool, and all of you I know have social media, small groups, large groups, it doesn't matter. Or go on to a group that you participate on and post something about the book. Link to the review that you've written, or link to Ari's review, which is a very good review. You know, do what you can just to get the word out there to your friends, to your acquaintances, to people you know. And again, the title is provocative, so it's likely the people will respond to the title. So just plug the title on your social media and link to where people can actually buy the book. And you're doing something on Reddit, aren't you, Don?
Yeah, I'm going to be doing a Reddit Ask Me Anything on the 30th. And, I mean, these are really popular, but basically, I mean, it's right in the name, right? You get to ask me anything. And for a couple hours, you know, I'll be answering it. And it can be, you know, anything about the book or connected to the book, any of these kind of inequality issues. And so, I mean, that's another thing you can let people know about in social media. Really looking forward to that. The other thing, so this, I don't know if this works, but my wife likes to do this, that whenever the book comes out, go into the bookstore and tell them, hey, why don't you have this, you know, more prominently displayed? So, and the more people who see the title, the better.
And I'd say more than that, I'd say, if you're going to buy the book in the next week, I would actually go to your local bookstore and buy it there. Go to a Barnes & Noble, but even better, go to an independent bookstore, usually run by a leftist, and ask about the book and try to see if they'll display it. Try to see if they'll sell it to you. Maybe even order it if they don't have it in stock. They should, but if they don't have it in stock. But those sales on the independent bookstores actually count more towards the different bestseller lists than Amazon sales do. So I know if you live in Portland, Oregon, go to Powell's. Powell's, the New York Times loves Powell's because they're a big bookstore, independent bookstore, and they're dominated by the left. Okay, last few minutes we have here. What are we trying to achieve with the book, Don? What do we hope will be the outcome from this book?
So I think the main thing that needs to be on the table is what is our view of success? And in particular, what is our moral evaluation of economic success? And I think that one of the, you know, we talked about the kind of failure of the right is that we do have a debate such as it is between, there's a sense that some people are for free markets and some people are for more government expansion. But there's no sense that there's a debate between those who think that there's something morally great about what free markets are about, which is the people pursuing profit, the people pioneering progress, the people driving achievement, and that therefore the people who are trying to interfere with it are not just costing us money. They're doing something profoundly unjust and immoral, which is they're punishing the best for being the best. They're punishing people and penalizing people not for their faults but for their virtues, which is a point that Ayn Rand talks about quite a bit. And once that moral choice is opened up to us, that is, are we going to be a country that penalizes success or a country that nurtures and celebrates it? I think that does so much to shift the debate in our direction, because I think the number one reason free markets are losing is because people don't see it as a moral choice. They see it as a choice of, in effect, well, how do we pump up GDP? And then the left basically takes the moral high ground by saying, well, if you care about morality, what you have to care about is failure, sacrifice, need. But no, if you care about morality, it's justice to virtue, including the virtue that's required to achieve great things economically.
Absolutely. I mean, the battle we're in is fundamentally a philosophical battle and fundamentally a moral battle. And you know, this is, we've got to be able to show people how morality plays out in life and what the consequences of bad morality are and what a good morality means. And each one of these books we put out, that's the attempt we're trying to make in another realm, to just pound away at what virtues actually mean and what impact that has on an individual life. Okay, great. Don, thanks. Thanks for being on the show today. I will see you in a couple of days in New York City. All of you are invited to join us. We're going to have a terrific event in New York on Tuesday, and go buy the books. Thanks, Don.
Can't wait. Thanks, Jerome.
Okay. All right, we're going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back. When I get back, I'm going to talk about Obama in Cuba, Obama in Argentina, and I'm also going to take, it looks like we've got another call on the line from an 808 number. So we're going to take that call when I get right back. You're listening to Ron Brooks Show. Don't go away.
The Ayn Rand Institute campus is an exciting online destination offering free e-courses on Ayn Rand and her revolutionary philosophy of objectivism. Whether you recently picked up your first Rand book or have been reading her novels and nonfiction for years, ARI Campus has something for you. On campus, you'll discover a variety of multimedia courses covering Rand's literary classics, specific aspects of thought, and how to apply her ideas to your life. Get started today at campus.aynrand.org. See you on campus.
With adoring fans, rabid critics, and very few in between, why does Atlas Shrugged evoke such impassioned responses? Because it grapples with the fundamental problems of human existence, and it presents radically new answers. Atlas Shrugged challenges many conventional notions about good and evil, that sex is a low animal desire, that money is the root of evil, that man is sinful by nature. One of the most prominent is the notion that selfishness is evil and self-sacrifice is good. Atlas Shrugged is a dramatization of Ayn Rand's unique vision of existence and of man's highest potential. 12 years in the writing, it is her masterwork. Rand's worldview emerges in the plot turns of this compelling mystery, centered on one question: who is John Galt? There are many legends. Which of these is true? Is he the man who discovered the Fountain of Youth? The man who found the lost city of Atlantis? A modern Prometheus? Does he even exist? And why, if no one knows the answer, does the entire world know his name? Find out the answer when you read the novel that sparked a philosophical revolution. Order it today on Amazon.com.
In 1934, Ayn Rand wrote to journalist and essayist H.L. Mencken, "Perhaps it may seem a lost cause at present, and there are those who will say that I am too late, that I can only hope to be the last fighter for a mode of thinking which has no place in the future. But I do not think so. I intend to be the first one in a new battle, which the world needs as it has never needed before. The first to answer the many too many advocates of collectivism, and answer them in a manner which will not be forgotten. Every day at ARI, we work to make sure that Ayn Rand's answer will not be forgotten. Help us. Contribute today at AynRand.org/support.
You've heard the endless warnings. Economic inequality is growing and will continue to grow. But the question almost no one asks is, who cares? It's an important question. Economic inequality has nothing to do with poverty. In some countries, people are relatively equal and extremely poor. In other countries, like the United States, people are relatively unequal, and the vast majority of people are, by world standards, extremely rich. Inequality just means there's a gap between what different people earn, and the gap can grow even if every single individual is becoming better off. And that's really the story of capitalism. Economic progress makes us all better off, just at different rates. So, why should we care about inequality? For more on inequality, see the new book by Yaron Brook and Don Watkins, Equal is Unfair, America's Misguided Fight Against Income Inequality, out in bookstores everywhere on March 29th. For more information, go to equalisunfair.com. That's equalisunfair.com.
Ayn Rand was a radical thinker whose philosophical novels challenged students to reconsider their views on fundamental issues. The Fountainhead, Atlas Shrugged, and Anthem, these works have become classics of American literature that never fail to engage young people and stimulate intense classroom discussion. By offering these works for free to teachers, the Ayn Rand Institute hopes to encourage greater awareness and understanding of Rand's stimulating perspective. If you're a teacher who would like Ayn Rand's books in your classroom, visit AynRand.org. This is at no cost to you. Go to AynRand.org today.
All right, we're back. And, you know, inequality, leads us to the next topic, which is a comparison that Obama has made between communism and capitalism. He did this in Argentina during a Q&A, fascinating, both in terms of what he actually said and actually how the media interpreted it. But it was very revealing of who Obama really is. But the whole trip to Cuba is unbelievably revealing of who Obama actually says. But before we do that, let's take this quick call from, who's this? You're on the line?
Aloha, it's Stuart.
Hey, Stuart, how's it going?
Oh, you know, I wanted to ask, I'm doing great. But I wanted to ask you about Cuba and the president. So, you know, so all these libertarians, these Cato Institute types, are cheering for Obama's trip to Cuba, and they're saying this is so great. And they said that Nixon's trip to China is a precedent. They said what will happen is, they said, well, when Nixon went to China, China opened up to the world, and it went in the direction of liberalization and capitalism. And these libertarians are saying the same thing will happen to Cuba. And Jeff Flake, the congressman, you know, whom I normally think is pretty good and not a flake, is agreeing with the libertarians. So they just assume that if Cuba's opening up trade with the USA, Cuba will liberalize. So I want to ask you about your thoughts on that.
Okay, I'm gonna take you off the air because I'm gonna go into a long rant about Cuba and Obama, and we're kind of running out of time. So thanks, Stuart. That's a perfect lead in because it's exactly what I want to talk about. Look, Let's take Nixon's visit to China. Nixon's visit to China had nothing to do with ultimately opening up China. What ultimately opened up China was the understanding by certain people within China once Mao Zedong was dead. Remember, Nixon visited China when Mao Zedong was alive. Nixon sanctioned by visiting, he sanctioned a regime that was responsible for probably the murder of 60 million people through self-inflicted starvation. Nixon's visit to China was completely immoral. Now, I do not object to Nixon's opening up of trade with China because I don't think China was an existential threat to the United States. And then I believe that you should only have a trade embargo on countries that are actually threatening to the United States. Iran, for example, North Korea. I do not think Cuba or China were or are threats, military threats to the United States. And indeed, Ayn Rand wrote that opening up trade to China made sense because the one country that was a threat to the United States, the Soviet Union, opening up trade to China would actually threaten the Soviets. And this was a good move, kind of a geopolitical move. But she was against Nixon actually going to China. So I separate two things out. Trade, which I think should be allowed with Cuba, and then each company and each individual has to decide whether they are willing to trade with a communist country, an explicitly communist country like Cuba. With Cuba, when you trade, you are probably trading with the government because all the money goes to the government and then the government pays everybody. 70% of Cuban population is in a sense employed, in quotes, by the government. That is not true in China. When you buy something from China, you are trading with an individual or a company that is independent for the most part from the Chinese, to the extent anybody's independent from the government. You're independent from the Chinese government, and therefore you're trading with a particular company, a particular individual. With Cuba, that's not clear. So I would not buy products made in Cuba. But if you want to, you have a political right to do so, even though I might think it's immoral to do it. You have a political right to do so. You're not helping a regime that is threatening my life. You're helping a regime that is threatening its own people's lives. But I don't have a political right to stop you because my life is not threatening. Now, if you're supporting in any way North Korea, you are helping a regime that is threatening to my life. And if it's threatening to my life, I have a right to stop you from doing it. Now, I'm not going to get into a whole discussion of China here. We've done this before, and I am very generally pro-trade with China and pro-China more broadly in spite of all the flaws, in spite of all the problems. You know, if you stop trading with places that have flaws and problems, or government is doing horrible things, you can't trade. You can't trade with anybody, because today, you know, we are all governments in the world are violating rights left or right. So, you know, anyway, it's a completely different thing, though, to have a president go to that country, to have diplomatic relations established with the country. I, for example, would have eliminated the embargo on Cuba. I would have not had any diplomatic relations with Cuba. Diplomatic relations with Cuba implies a sanction of the Cuban regime. Diplomatic relations with any country sanction that regime. So I would categorize all countries into three. One, threatening. No diplomatic relations, no trade, nothing, right? And if possible, eliminate the threat using military force if the threat is real. Two, countries that are fundamentally, essentially immoral and unfree, but that are not threatening, like Cuba, I would allow trade, but no diplomatic relations. The idea that an American president would go to Cuba, the idea that an American president would schmooze Castro, who was, this is Fidel Castro's brother, Raul Castro, was an executioner, literally shot businessmen, wealthy people in the early parts of the regime's history, literally pulled the trigger himself to kill people. That is sick. It is sick. As sick, as in my view, as Nixon going to China and schmoozing with a dictator responsible for the deaths of 60 million. And then for Obama then to be lectured to by Raul Castro about how we don't have universal health care and we don't have universal education, I guess, is sick. And to let him get away with that and to agree with it. Obama agrees with it, and then he later cites it in the speech he gave in Argentina, which I'll get to in a minute, is sick. I mean, it is so revealing of the unethical, the immorality of this president. This president is an immoral president. He is an evil, he holds evil ideas and is an evil person because he's smart enough to know that his ideas are evil. And this whole trip to Cuba and Argentina is an illustration of that. Evil. I said evil and I mean evil, not just bad, evil. Because he is sanctioning a regime that is killing people right now. You know, right before Obama got to Cuba, they rounded up and put in jail the critics of the regime. It's just unbelievable to me that a president would go. You know, even if he planned to go, as soon as he heard that, he should have withdrawn. All right. So he should have never gone to Cuba. Cuba is a fundamentally unfree, a fundamentally oppressive regime, a murdering regime, and a regime that stands in opposition to everything the United States believes in. And he should never have gone to Cuba. Now, nothing wrong with him going to Argentina. Argentina is, in essential terms, a free country. In essential terms, I mean, it's got major, major problems, and its government is majorly corrupt, and it violates rights left and right. But it's essentially free. There's a line somewhere, and it's hard to draw that line in the world we live in today. It's not easy to draw that line in the world we live in today. But most of the countries in Latin America, with exception maybe of Venezuela, most of the countries in Europe, and most of the countries, I would say, even in Asia, this is the big trend over the last 50 years. How much more freedom there is in the world today than there was 50 years ago. It's unbelievable. Since the Berlin Wall, since the wall fell, and since the Soviet Union was dismantled, the number of people in the world who live under basically, in a certain sense, free regimes is astounding and all good. This is part of the why be positive and why be optimistic about the state of the world, because that is truly amazing. You know, he went to Argentina, and that's fine, and he danced the tango, which looked on television a little embarrassing. And what was really embarrassing, I guess, was he was dancing the tango while there was this massive investigation into what was going on in Brussels. And it seemed like he was taking the whole terrorism thing lightly because of other things he'd said anyway. But I think that's all superficial stuff. What's interesting is the speech he gave in Argentina. And you can catch this on YouTube. Just put Obama communism at capitalism and it comes up. And I'm going to read you some of the speech because I think it's so interesting. So this is Obama speaking. I guess to make about a point. So often in the past, there's been a sharp division between left and right, between capitalist and communist or socialist. And especially in the Americas, that's been a big debate, right? Oh, you know, you're a capitalist Yankee dog. And oh, you know, you're some crazy communist that's going to take away everybody's property. Now, I'll stop there for a minute. Notice the moral equivalency between a capitalist Yankee dog and a crazy communist. Capitalist Yankee dogs don't slaughter people. They don't murder people. They don't steal in mass. They produce, they create, they build. And even if you think capitalism represents the cronyism that exists today, so even if you have this modern view of capitalism, it's a gazillion times better than communism. So even if you take the worst interpretation of capitalism, that is of the cronyism that exists today, to create such a moral, such an equivalence between crazy communist who wants to take away everybody's property and a capitalist Yankee dog. First of all, taking away everybody's property is such a violation of rights that it doesn't exist. Nothing similar to that exists under capitalism, even the mixed economy pseudo-capitalism that they pretend exists today under the name of capitalism. But that's not all crazy communists did. They actually kill people, slaughter people en masse. But he goes on to say that's not enough. And I mean, those are interesting intellectual arguments. Oh my God. These are just, it's just an intellectual argument, the difference between capitalism and communism. I mean, I'm stunned that he would publicly say this, even though I know he actually believes this, but he would publicly say this in a public forum, taped on YouTube, and then nobody would make a big deal out of it. I was watching Fox all the time, and all they showed on Fox was him dancing the tango instead of focusing on this. This is truly horrific, truly evil. And he goes on to say, right? But I think for your generation, you should be practical and just choose from what works. Yeah, you know, the things in communism that work. We'll get to that in a minute. You don't have to worry about whether it neatly fits into socialist theory or capitalist theory. God forbid we should have any theory. You should just decide what works. Okay, so what Obama is doing here is giving a major speech on the virtues of pragmatism, of pure pragmatism. Now, if you've read The Dim Hypothesis, Leonard Peikoff's Dim Hypothesis, this is a major D, disintegration. Nothing's integrate. You do a little bit here, a little bit there. Do what works. By what standard works, he never says, right? But do what works. Obama, Trump, most of these leftist politicians, pure evil pragmatism. But not even the normal pragmatism of everyday life that at least that so many politicians at least try to say, well, this is consistent with the founding of this is full markets or something like that. No, this is pragmatism on principle. Pragmatism being unprincipled on principle. He goes on to say, and as I said this to President Castro, yeah, in his discussions with the commie murderer, I said, look, you've made great progress in educating young people. Yeah. You killed their parents, but you educated the young people. And by the way, really? How educated are Cubans, really? Every child in Cuba gets a basic education. That's a huge improvement for where it was. Medical care. The life expectancy of Cubans is equivalent to the United States, despite it being a very poor country, because they have access to health care. Now, I doubt the causal relationship there. But that's for another time. We can talk about that. But notice, you know, communism does some things good. It does education good. It does health care good. I wonder what the life expectancy of Cubans would be if they didn't rely on technology invented in the United States. If they didn't buy drugs made by those capitalist, even capitalist countries, or medical devices created by those evil capitalist companies in capitalist economies. I mean, the amount of evasion, evil evasion, is just stunning, stunning to me here. Okay, he goes on. That's a huge achievement of communism. They should be congratulated. This is stunning. Just think about what he's saying. But you drive around Havana. Now's the negative about, there's a few negative things about Cuba. You drive around Havana and you say, this economy is not working. It looks like it did in the 1950s. And so you have to be practical, right? Pragmatic. In asking yourself, how can you achieve the goals of equality and inclusion? Equal is unfair. Remember the book? It's everywhere. How can you achieve the goals of equality and inclusion, but also recognize that the market system produces a lot of wealth and goods and services? So how do you balance equality with a market economy because you want some wealth? Well, you allow Obama's solution to this is you allow people to pretend like they've got freedom, to pretend they've got property rights, so they create the wealth and then you steal it from them. And it also gives individual freedom because they have initiative. So it's good to have individual freedom because that helps them create wealth so that you can steal it, so that you can give people an equal education, equal Medicare, and equal other stuff. I mean, this is very explicit. Now, by the way, all these arguments are what the book deals with, so go buy the book. And as you – and this he continues. And so you don't have to be rigid in saying it's either this or that. Yeah, don't be rigid about life or death. You know, you can have a little bit of both. You can say, depending on the problem you're trying to solve, depending on the social issues that you're trying to address, what works? And I think that what you'll find is that the most successful societies, the most successful economies are ones that are rooted in a market-based system. Note, he's not slamming market-based systems, but also recognize that a market does not work by itself. It has to have a social and moral and ethical community basis, and there has to be inclusion. So you need a market system, and you need altruism, collectivism, and that's Obama. We want to exploit the market system for the sake of equality. That's the pseudo-left. Now, what he's hiding here is the nihilism that really drives him. But what he's expressing here is what Bernie Sanders would call democratic socialism. We want to allow you enough freedom to create the wealth so that we can steal it. Now, think about Atlas Shrugged. Isn't this the theme of Atlas? Isn't this what Atlas Shrugged is all about? So a very, very powerful speech, message from President Obama. Quite astounding that it would be this explicit. And we could do a whole show just on those few paragraphs, a whole show just analyzing that, and maybe we will at some point. But right now, we are kind of running out of time. And I want to end, as usual, on a positive note. So two positive notes, really. One is, I'm excited. I'm hoping some of you are excited. Don was certainly excited about the fact that we've got a book coming out this week. And so Tuesday is the formal publication date. If you buy the book, this week is the time to buy it. It will really help. The more you delay, the less important your purchase is to the big effort. Of course, you buy your show. You buy it when you buy it. If you buy from a local bookstore, that's an advantage over Amazon or Barnes & Noble. Buy it in any format you want. They all count. It's available on the Kindle, on the Nook, in hardback copy, and also in Audible. All right. So I want to make a recommendation, book, movie recommendation, because I think they're both good. The book is a trilogy, which I read a few years ago. And then yesterday on a flight, I watched the movie. So it reminded me of it, or the first movie, because there were actually three. And in the version I watched it, there were actually six, because it's an expanded version, a director's cut of The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. And I really enjoyed these books, these thrillers that were written by Swede. And you know, if you, all you're focused on is the politics, you would say, you know, you enjoyed them because they portray Swedish society as not that great. And maybe Bernie Sanders should learn something from it. But no, that's not why I enjoyed the books. I enjoyed the books because they really portray heroes, interesting heroes, heroes that are overcoming real issues, real conflicts, and heroes that win by using their minds. Elizabeth Salander, I think I'm pronouncing that right. I mean, she is this woman who has had a horrific upbringing, a horrific, horrific upbringing. And any left to say she has no chance in life. She's doomed to failure. She's doomed to suffer. She there's no way she can do well. There's no way she could ever be successful. And yet she is. Not only is she successful because she's a genius, I mean, she is a genius, so that helps, but she applies her genius. She doesn't just accept her fate. And the books keep repeating this. She keeps suffering setbacks, and she uses her mind. She focuses it. She wills herself to overcome the setbacks. And this is kind of the way she is portrayed. This is exactly her personality from when she's a child. She won't tolerate injustice. She is horrified by injustice. She stands up to it. She uses her skills to correct it. And essentially her skill is brain power. She's a hacker. She's a computer hacker, a genius at computer hacking. But also, in spite of the way she's portrayed, which is a slightly autistic, or at least if not autistic, then has zero social skills. And that's another thing. You know, she didn't go to one of these progressive schools where the purpose of education is to socialize you. She was never socialized. She was never socialized. But that's part of her charm, and that's part of her genius, and it's part of what allows her to focus and allows her to overcome all these challenges. She goes right to the heart of the problem. Her mind is completely in focus, constantly focused on the essentials and not on the inessentials. She creates human relationships when those human relationships are important. Now, she has been scarred, so it's very difficult for her to be happy. It's very difficult for her to be completely close to somebody. But, you know, but that's what makes this interesting, is to see her try to overcome that. And at least in the first book, towards the end, she is trying to overcome even that part of her. And she later develops friendship and some relationships. Okay. So I am recommending Stieg Larsson's book, The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, the entire trilogy. Now, I actually think the first one is the best, and the third one is the least good. But I would recommend reading them all. In a sense, the third one doesn't have a plot. The third one is just a conclusion of the story, started in the first one, where you get to sort of climax in the second one, and the third one is the conclusion. But I would read them all. And then I did watch the Swedish movie of it yesterday, the director's cut. It's on iTunes. It's 3 hours and something long. So it's a good for one of those long flights. The movie was very good. I really enjoyed it. So I watched the first one. I'm still going to watch the next couple. It actually breaks it up into two. So the movie was actually two movies, each about an hour and a half, an hour 40 minutes long. Very, very good. Very well acted. Very well, you know, directed. Would strongly recommend. So this week's recommendation is The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. The book trilogy, the movie trilogy, really, you know, great heroes that use their mind. And the movies, by the way, I recommend in particular the Swedish ones. The American movie was okay, but it wasn't anywhere near as good as the Swedish one. And of course, the Swedish-made movies of all three in America, only the first one was made and it flopped, so they never made the other ones. But recommend the Swedish movies. All right, we've been recommending foreign movies lately. So we covered a lot today. Hope you enjoyed it. Please help promote the show, the Iran Brook Show, and go out. This is the week. This is the time. Help us promote Equal is Unfair. Go bite the book. Write about it on social media. You know, debate people on Reddit or whatever with it. And then come to our events. Look up ari.aynrand, aynrand.org/events. Come to an event. I'll sign your book. I'll even sign your Kindle, whatever you want. And just show up. We've got a lot of exciting events coming up in the next few weeks, the next few months. Hope to see you all there. Have a great weekend. Talk to you next week. You'll be listening to your Iran Brook Show.